So,
oh, we've got.
Oh.
I'm opening this meeting of House, well, the meeting of the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, February 23rd. We have a few things on our agenda. We will begin with a work session. I'm opening the work session on House Bill 4023 relating to broadband technology. Mr. McSpadden.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 4023, relates to broadband technology. Two public hearings and work sessions on House Bill 4023 were held earlier this month in the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. The measure was voted out of committee, due pass with amendments and with referrals to the JLCIMT and then on to the ways to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. House Bill 4023A directs the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council to study options for a local broadband champion program and report findings to the Legislative Assembly by December 1st, 2018. Further, the measure creates the Connecting Oregon Schools Fund for the purpose of providing matching funds for federal monies received by school districts for broadband access. The measure appropriates $750,000 from the general fund to the Connecting Oregon Schools Fund, establishes eligibility criteria, and requires the State Board of Education to adopt rules. And finally, the measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage. On behalf of the co-chairs, I have posted a recommended A13 amendment to the bill. For some context behind the need for the amendment, the state CIO has formed a partnership with Oregon's four research universities called Oregon Fiber to provide more affordable, reliable, and higher speed broadband connectivity to state agencies and partner universities. As a reminder, the state CIO and his staff have been before this committee on several occasions to brief the JLCMT on this broadband initiative. The Oregon Fiber Initiative will utilize and connect, very importantly, to existing fiber resources that are already in the ground, either live or dark fiber. They've done this via contract, via public procurement process. The intent is to create a public fiber network with last mile connectivity to state office and university locations provided by telecommunications service providers operating throughout Oregon via contracting. As you all may know, state agency and university facilities are located in communities all across Oregon, often within a few miles or just down the road from tribal government, local government, school, library, and other public body locations. Under current law, the state CIO is authorized to provide advanced digital telecommunications or broadband services only to state agencies and nonprofit organizations under certain circumstances. Under current law, these tribal governments and other public bodies would be unable to access the enhanced broadband communication services that are made possible by the Oregon Fiber Network. Generally, the A13 amendment allows the state CIO to provide these broadband communication services upon request to local government special districts and federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon via one of two paths. A process to be described in rule if it's determined that the broadband services to be provided would not duplicate services already offered by telecommunications providers in areas to be served, or following a public hearing and adoption of a resolution by a governing body of a municipality or other public body in the area to be served by the state CIO, finding that the proposed broadband services and operations are necessary and would not otherwise be provided by a for-profit entity within a reasonable time and for a reasonable cost. The amendment requires the state CIO to adopt rules for providing these services under an extended rulemaking process, utilizing an inclusive rules advisory committee designed to ensure full participation by interested parties prior to rule adoption. Finally, the amendment requires the state CIO to present the proposed rules to this committee prior to rules adoption. The materials related to the House bill are posted on OLIS, including the recommended A13 amendment, the preliminary staff measure summary, the fiscal impact statement, my LFO work session memo. We were informed by Legislative Revenue Office that House Bill 4023A, as it might be amended by the A13 amendment, has no revenue impact. Co-Chair Nathanson, as you know, we have some invited guests here to share their thoughts on both the bill and the A13 amendment.
We do. Before I call up the guests, we've heard your explanation of the amendment, which was posted yesterday. People have had some time to look at it. I would like to ask you a few questions to make sure that we're all on the same page here with what this additional proposed amendment does. First, the first one is actually two parts. Is the state building new internet pipelines?
The answer would be no. The state is not building anything.
And the second part of that is, are we spending money laying new conduit to put in new fiber optic cables to connect hundreds of miles of new information highways? I think you already answered, but
the answer is no. The state of Oregon and the four research universities are connecting to existing fiber via a public contracting process.
Okay. The second question: if the private sector is providing service to a school, a municipal library, a county sheriff's office, those sorts of public entities, is the state going to be putting in a line to offer a competing service?
The answer would be no. This is where the rulemaking comes in. Rulemaking will define the conditions under which service can be provided and under which circumstances it won't be provided. Certainly a local government has the ability to have a public hearing, adopt a resolution to indicate that service can't be provided in a reasonable time or a reasonable cost. But I've been assured the answer is no.
So I'm going to emphasize this to be really clear. Apart from rulemaking, the fundamental statute, if the amendment were adopted, the fundamental statute would be clear, though, that if there's already private service, the state doesn't put in additional service to compete to that school or that sheriff's office.
The only way I can answer that is that we've been assured both directly and in stakeholder meetings that just happened this week that the state does not have the intention of competing with the private sector. It is prohibited under existing law from offering a competing service to any private sector customer, mm-hmm. and only under conditions outlined in rulemaking or through a local municipality's current authority would the service be provided.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask it sort of one step beyond that. If the state sees that there's a gap in service somewhere, which is what this is about, someplace that isn't being served, which is generally rural areas, if there's an area not being served, the school, the sheriff's office, the whatever, can't get broadband. So the state CIO is prepared to now make that service available. But through this advance notice, the private sector says, wait a sec, we can do it. Is the state still going to do it?
The answer would be no. The rulemaking would define that would be a situation in which the state would not provide the service.
So if the private sector is already there or says it can be and will be there, then the state's not going to take away the private sector's opportunity.
That's correct. The state, important fundamental approach here to understand is that it's the local government, the school, the tribal government that would make a request to the state under mm-hmm. any circumstance. Mm-hmm. The state is connecting the Oregon Fiber Network with its partners in the four university mm-hmm. Research universities to serve its own needs. The concept here is that network will travel to every corner of Oregon where mm-hmm. state office buildings and university locations exist, and against many times right by the front door of some of these other public body locations. If they are underserved, it would be up to those bodies to request service, and then it would be governed by rulemaking or their own inherent authority that under current law that they have.
And then my last question, before bringing up all the speakers, is if the state turns on the dark fiber in a region that isn't being served, is that potentially opening up new opportunities for business for the private sector?
Absolutely. First of all, the university systems in the state of Oregon are, through a public contracting process, they are utilizing existing fiber, or they are paying the owner of the dark fiber to light it up. That provides the opportunity then for last mile connections to be ordered by the customer organization from a private sector provider in the area, again via a contract.
So the state CIO isn't connecting directly to the school. The school contracts with a private provider to make that connection.
I suppose there could be some situations where the state CIO would be the contracting organization, but it would be a contract with the private sector provider in the area.
Okay. Thank you. We have a few invited speakers, and I have asked them all to limit their time. And so, with advance apologies to even the elected officials here, everybody's going to try to hold their comments to a couple of minutes. Representative Pam Marsh, please, and Representative David Brock Smith.
And if you could please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you. Co-Chair Nathanson and Riley, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the House Representative for District 5, which is Southern Jackson County. I sit on the Economic Development and Trade Committee, as does Rep. Clem. And I am here today just to give you a little bit of background as to how this bill traveled in its course to you. Way back in November, our committee submitted a bill concept that was very general. It had a relating clause that noted broadband and very little substance. By the beginning of the short session, we had four juicy amendments to consider, two of which have been adopted into the bill that's in front of you. The first one was to establish an E-rate match fund, and that, of course, allows the state to use a small amount of state funds to match with as much as 10-to-1 on the federal level for the purpose of connecting schools to the internet. Nothing not to like about that concept, and we feel very strongly in forwarding it to you. The second amendment, which was also integrated into the bill, was to establish a local champions program. We know that broadband across the state has been places where it's vital and active have been the result of local champions, where you have people with knowledge and passion about the issue and the opportunity to act upon it. We thought building on that capacity and trying to figure out how we can really share the knowledge base that we have about broadband into some of our other rural corners was an important step forward, and we accepted that amendment. And then we had two amendments proposed by the state CIO, which would have allowed the state CIO to use the excess capacity of the fiber network. The first one addressed using it with other public agencies. The second to develop public-private partnerships so that last-mile services could be provided to communities in a commercial way. We knew that there was some concern. Industry stepped forward to note that they wanted to know more about how this might all work. And we got to work seeing if we could create some sideboards, some constraints, so that people would feel comfortable with the use of the excess fiber capacity. Over time, and we had very little time, as you know, short session rushes by, we winnowed down specifically on the question of whether we could come up with an amendment which would allow the state CIO to serve other public entities, schools, libraries, city halls. And we felt pretty passionately about this because it really matches with the E-rate match fund. E-rate match fund can be done with private providers, but if you have additionally the capacity to match that E-rate state funding with hookups on the state's fiber network, very quickly you could have something that was both powerful and inexpensive. We did our best, and we could not come up. We didn't have enough time to come up with the right sideboards and the language that made people feel comfortable. So at the last minute, some of us suggested that we ask the speaker for permission to forward the bill to you all to see if you would have an opportunity to work on that amendment. And I mention all of this so that you know that there's a history to this conversation. It's a short history over the last few weeks, but it's one that we were pretty engaged in on that committee and appreciated the opportunity to hand it off to you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, David Brock-Smith, Vice Chair of the Economic Development and Trade Committee for the House and State Representative for House District 1. I appreciate my colleague here, Representative Marsh, for the backstory on this. And we were together collectively in trying to figure out just what we can do to really bring this to what you have here today. And I appreciate all of your work as well, Co-Chair Nathanson, on really trying to get at the security that industry needs to move forward, but providing really the platform for the public utility or public entity service in rural Oregon. I'm blessed in my district to have some of the best connectivity that from the industry, but not all districts in rural Oregon are blessed to do so. In fact, some districts in rural Oregon have the fiber to the courthouse, literally in the courthouse, and inside the courthouse right next door is the clerk's office that does not have access to the same broadband that the courthouse does. And that to me is ridiculous. And this will help fix that. And so what we've done here with these amendments, and I want to be very clear on the legislative intent that we're discussing, and I appreciate your questions earlier, that the legislative intent that we're discussing here is that the rulemaking process, again, is going to be 60 days. Thank you. We've already put a lot on the record in this committee to protect industry, if you will. Industry is still going to be able to provide the last mile of service. We're going to be able to leverage those E-rate dollars and the state dollars to leverage that opening of that hole, so to speak, to put those service to the last mile. We're going to be able to have the legislative intent through the rulemaking process to guarantee a first right of refusal, if you will, for the industry, that we can't really find that language because of some conflicts with the DOJ and our legislative councils. We're going to make sure that these are going, which is already on the record, to the unserved areas through that rulemaking process. We're creating a board to govern it all. And, you know, I think that we've done our diligence through this process, and I appreciate all of the conversations that we've had. I know that we're talking about the short session and things are moving quickly, but I was fortunate enough, just real quick, to go to the Wireless Youth Symposium in San Francisco, as Representative Fahey was the other House member. And what's happening in regards to wireless and 5G and broadband and all of this around the country and the state, this will allow really the opportunity to leverage state and federal dollars to expedite those areas in rural Oregon so that anybody that wants to visit John Day from Portland will have the same sophistication in broadband service that they have in Portland. And I really hope that this committee looks hard, stays involved. This is one opportunity where we actually have this committee has the opportunity to look and be a part of the rulemaking process. I look to have a bill that takes that on in the 19th session, but because I think it's important that our OARs match our ORSs, and right now we're doing that in real time. So I appreciate the work. I would ask my colleagues to support the Dash 13 amendments and move forward together in providing broadband to rural Oregon.
Thank you both. Questions of these two? Thanks.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like two people to come up. let's see, yeah, we have two chairs, but not three, so let's do it this way. Mr. Wolf, representing Telecommunications Association of Oregon. And by the way, I'm going to give you an extra minute in case there's anything in the written testimony posted by Mr. Hendricks that you'd like to highlight for us, since he's not, he didn't make it here, right? We just have
Coach Nathanson, he was not able to make it, but we did post his written remarks.
And then after that, we'll hear from Association of Oregon Counties and OCHEN and Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. You have my written comments in front of you. And I would also point out to you, we have one written response that you should have seen on OLIS from one of our member companies, Eagle Telephone Systems in Richland, Oregon. I would urge you to pay more attention to what Ms. Latin said than to what I am going to say to you, even though we kind of are going to say the same thing. But I think she needs to be listened to. You guys see me around here all the time. And those voices really out there that are actually providing the service are the ones that you ought to take into consideration. First and foremost, we support House Bill 4023, the Angros version. We support the establishment of the fund that's been referred to here. Some of our members use the E-rate programs to serve these local schools. It's a great program, and it works really, really well. I tried to point out a couple of things in my written testimony, some issues we have with the Dash 13 amendment. We don't support the Dash 13 amendment, but that doesn't mean we don't support the goal that's trying to be achieved. We do. We recognize there are unserved areas in this state, there are underserved areas in this state, and those folks deserve access to broadband the same as anybody else does. Our main overarching objection to this is the process. I've heard Mr. McSpadden and you all indicate that you've heard several times from the CIO, and I'll just ask rhetorically how many times you've heard from the industry on this matter. How many hearings have been held for the industry, and how much data has been gathered from the industry on this matter? I'll answer my own question. I don't think it's any. This process needs to be broader, more complete. If this was done at the Public Utility Commission in a normal administrative hearings kind of process, this would take 6 to 8 months. You would have witnesses, testimony, data would be gathered, and conclusions could be drawn. We think that's the right process, maybe not through the PUC, but certainly through a group of folks who are interested in this matter. I put one little thing in here just for your consideration. Last session, the Oregon Telecommunications Association passed and got signed into law a bill that would allow the Oregon Universal Service Fund to support broadband networks. That took us well over a year visiting with legislators all over the state, with our industry colleagues, and despite all that, it still had to be amended once we got here for the regular session. It's a long, lengthy process, but it works. And I would just recommend to you all that you, rather than take up the Dash 13s, direct us all to go back to the drawing table, to the drawing board, and work on this during the interim and bring you a bill in 2019 that we all can support. The industry, the stakeholders, education, everyone. That's our request to you. Pass the bill in the Angros version and don't take up the Dash 13 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
I appreciate it, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Absolutely. Association of Oregon Counties and Department of Education, let's hear from you two next.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'd like to apologize on behalf of Mike MacArthur, our executive director, who was originally scheduled to be here with you today, so I'm his sorry substitute. But we do, AOC does support the bill with the Dash 13 amendments. We join our local government partners, League of Oregon Cities, in doing so. We consider counties to be a partner with you. The state providing many essential services as shared services, as Representative Brock Smith alluded to, things like public safety, elections, human services, veterans, and we do believe it's in the best interest of the public to be able to provide those services at a level where the best technology is available. As you know many rural areas that technology is not available. So if we are able to partner with the state to make best use of resources, we would like to do so. And we believe the Dash 13 amendment provides the intergovernmental cooperation that's necessary in order for us to proceed. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee. My name is Jessica Wynn Ventura, Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education. I am here on behalf of the department to support the Connecting Oregon School Funds created under House Bill 4023A. In the back, I also have Carla Wade, who's the Digital Innovations Lead at the Oregon Department of Education, who can provide some more information on the technical aspects of the bill. Under the E-Rate program, the FCC provides eligible applicants with up to 10% discount for special construction charges, matching state funding for the project on a dollar-to-dollar basis. In May of 2016, the department received around $273,000 from the emergency fund to support six school districts with a one-time state match fund for these type of construction charges. The department supports the creation of a state match fund by the legislature to optimize the use of any funding allocated for this effort. A state match fund will mitigate issues caused by unpredictable schedules and challenges that exist in this construction of scalable infrastructure. This fund will also provide the vehicle to further leverage additional matching funds from the E-Rate program, roughly around $6 to $10 million from the federal government. We estimate that there are about 43 school districts and charter schools without adequate internet connectivity that could take advantage of the state match funds to leverage further funding from the E-Rate program. Of the 43 identified as high need, we have determined that 17 of these submitted an application through the E-Rate program, and four have notified the department that will move forward with the projects. The special construction costs for these schools districts would be eligible for the state match, for the 10% state match, if established by the legislature, and an additional 10% under the federal E-Rate program. The combined estimated project cost is approximately $6.7 million, with a current project funding gap of approximately $1.5 million. Based on our estimates, a state match investment of $665,500 would reduce the funding gap to $182,000. Digital equity is a concern to the department, as inequities related to broadband access persist when students, particularly rural and low-income students, do not have the same level of broadband and device access as other students outside of the school. We have an opportunity to play a critical role in promoting the availability of equitable broadband access among our schools. With this in mind, the Department of Education asked that the Joint Committee on Information Management and Technology approve House Bill 4023A engrossed. And I also want to thank Representative Marsh and her leadership on this bill, and also thank you for considering the bill. With that, I'll take any questions.
Yes, Senator
DeMore. Was that with the Dash 16 or without?
13.
Or 13, excuse me.
We are in support of the base bill. We are neutral on the amendment. Any other questions you would have, I would ask you.
Thank you. You
direct those to the CIO's office.
I will have an additional question, but I'll ask it of Mr. McSpadden. With the E-rate, there's an ability to help pay for a connection, but what if there's no highway to connect to? That was kind of the point.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should just leave it at that. There was nothing to connect to. So, and Mr. Singh, I'll ask you. So you must be interested in connectivity for some counties where there are services, either the main county courthouse or other county facilities where there is currently no access to the broadband internet highway. Is that right?
That's correct, Madam Co-Chair. I think there's plenty of examples out there where that partnership could be created. And then just some examples I'd pull from maybe public safety. We have some counties, some cities that have very high-tech technology in their cars and at police stations, precincts, some sheriff's offices and other rural city police departments that are still writing reports via Microsoft Word or whatnot. So the connectivity disconnect is there, and anything that we can do to kind of bridge that gap, whether it be with a partnership through the state or with private industry whatever that cooperation is, we would like to ensure that access is available for citizens and also the essential services that counties and cities provide.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you both. Let's hear now from Ochin. And I just said your acronym. Maybe you better tell us the whole thing when you introduce yourself.
Members of the committee, Chair Nathanson, Chair Riley, Jennifer Stoll, for the record, representing OCHIN, the Oregon Community Health Information Network, but we are OCHIN. So OCHIN is a 501(c) nonprofit today, proudly supporting this bill, 4023A, and with the dash 13s. We're supportive because what we do is, as a technology nonprofit supporting safety net, rural hospitals, and public health, is we work to pull down FCC's Telehealth Connect Fund dollars to enable telehealth throughout the state of Oregon. We've worked really hard to work with partners to bring broadband throughout the state, but we still see tremendous unmet need to the marketplace and lots of different areas, especially around hospitals and rural and frontier clinics. And this need is fairly tremendous. We're also seeing a need for growing mental health and behavioral health, addiction services and treatments, especially around the opioid component, and that this will be an important piece to being able to address the crisis. So I'm here in support of the bill today and happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. That's the end of the testimony that we have planned for today. Committee, we're going to be at ease, stand at ease for just a couple of minutes while we thank you. We're no longer at ease. There has been a request to hear directly from the CIO, the Chief Information Officer. So will you please come forward? And first just introduce yourself, and then we will ask the questions for you to answer.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon.
Thank you. My first thing is going to be to read from the dash A13, page 3. Do you have that in front of you?
I can grab it very quickly.
There's a lot of conversation about, well, there's really no assurance here that the state wouldn't just go ahead and overbuild or provide service that the private sector is already providing. And on page 13, section 6, there's some language about you determining whether there what you are doing would duplicate, sir, it's in line 20, would duplicate services already offered by a telecommunications provider. So the crux of this is there something here that says you're not going to overbuild and you're not going to go directly competing with the private sector? So that's the crux of the conversation. Where is it in writing, and what is your intent? And now I'm going to allow first the senators to ask questions. Senator DeBoer.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Director Pettit, I think you have framed the question.
Okay.
So first of all, do you support the 13th Amendment? Second of all, the answer to the questions.
Madam Co-Chair, Chair Riley, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, thank you for the question. The direct answer is yes, I do support the Dash 13 amendment. To more directly answer, though, the concern on line 20, page 3, that's expressed, as I would expect, this will be something that we will work through and rule. If I were to draw the parallel with the state of Utah or with the state of Oklahoma, where this has been done before, these networks, these systems that the states have procured or have, in some cases, with grant money from the federal government, have built, were built with contractors, were built with the telecommunications firms of those states. And the point being to extend the franchise of broadband access to people that don't have it today. Now, in this process, I can give you my assurance, not only of the process of our intent to not overbuild and to not go into competition with any ILEC or even a competitive local exchange carrier, ILEC being an incumbent local exchange carrier. But in addition to that, as part of this process that has been outlined, we will be developing rules. We will work with members of the telecommunications service firms. We will work with other groups. We will bring those rules to this committee as part of that process before they are adopted to ensure that they are, in fact, the OARs are supportive of the intent that we're trying to make here in law. So I think that there's a level of nuance of what do I want to call it here, I guess, elaboration of these rules that has to occur, and that these need to be developed. And then as we get that done, as that process is worked over a 60-day period, then to come back and have you review those. And yes, that does conform to how it is we intended this to be, or no, it does not.
Follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Does delay of us approving the 13 amendment affect your ability to do this?
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, thank you for the question. What it will do is we have a project underway currently to connect up our state facilities. A couple of weeks ago I gave a presentation on that project. So there's 642 or 43 state facilities around the state of Oregon that we're lighting up. As an example, one of those facilities, we're going to be concentrating along Interstate 5. One of those facilities that does not currently have connectivity is Shampooey Park. So that's a state park that doesn't have. We'll be going right up Highway 219. As we go up 219, we're going to go through, that's the state right away. We're going to go, I say we'll be going up, I really mean one of the folks that's going to connect up our stuff to Shampooey is going to be going up 219, because that's where we have the right-of-way. When that's completed, it will go through the town of St. Paul. There's a municipal library there. There's other facilities there. We're just going to go past them. We're just going to go past them right now. This will change fundamentally what it is our design is, because it changes our design objective, And so where we're at in the engineering process, you define what your design objectives, and then you come up with your specific designs and your project plans, and then your elaborated engineering specs. You bid them out, you do all that kind of thing. That's what this is all about for us. So our expectation is if things go the way that, no IT project goes the way that you want to go. However, given granted that, in 18 months, I think that starting on I-5, I will have completed the I-5 connections, and then I will turn my attention to the outlying ones. I'm a lazy engineer. I don't like to do the work twice.
So,
yes, if I may, Riley.
So, was your answer to his question yes?
Yes.
Okay. And what I wanted to say is I can assure you that as co-chair of this committee that you will be coming back here with with the rules before we let you go forward. So,
yes.
Yes, Senator Linthicum.
With follow-up, I think the problem that I have is the rules aren't here. That we don't see them. So, Sean, if you'll excuse me going directly to your answer to the chair's, co-chair's questions, you said no to all of the, she formed a question and you articulated no, the rulemaking would define, and you continued the answer. I think the correct answer is, well, I don't know, because the rulemaking will define how it's going to play out, because we don't know what those rules look like. What we have is on line 12 of the very first page, we've got a may that becomes a shall on line 13. Shall provide broadband communication services and operations. If the state information offer provides those services, they have to meet and be in a manner that is, quote, consistent with the state chief information officer's rules, policies, and standards. But we don't know what those are. And he cannot do it where there's competition and that is inconsistent with the chief officer's rules, standards, policies, et cetera. So my only problem with this, you know, envelope that we're painting is it's really the size of a moving van. I mean, we don't know what's going to get stuffed into it during the day, and I'm wondering why those particulars. I believe you. I understand where you're coming from. I recognize the dilemma we face, but none of that is documented here. And in instance after instance, we fall back on the fact that the state chief information officer shall adopt rules governing how it provides broadband services. We don't see those rules. We don't know what they're going to look like. And therefore, I'm very hesitant to just say slam dunk, let's go. I think this particular item does not belong in a short session. It belongs in a long session where we can get players on all sides, you know, to have a good game. That's just opinion. And actually, there's a question in there. Why aren't some of these items put into the bill?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. The direct answer is because, quite frankly, I view this, I guess the way that I see this is more of a potential missed opportunity than I do really as something that's necessarily that we've gone through and made the assumption that everyone will think that this is something that should be done. Certainly from my seat, from being the IT professional, I look at this as saying this is a missed opportunity for the state. So having done this on a couple of different places, I kind of harken back or parallel it with the Rural Electrification Act in 1936. So I see this as an opportunity to make an investment with and promote things for the private sector to do, to connect up, to do things that, and give them an opportunity, a platform to begin bringing this out with me as the anchor tenant. Now, having said that, I don't know if this is really from the purposes of the state chief information officer and cutting my costs from $20 per meg per month to $1 a meg per month. That's out of the, you know, fundamentally, I don't know if you see that as the same kind of lost opportunity as I do.
Follow up. This comes to Senator DeBoer's question with regard to timeliness. Does not adopting the Dash 13s prevent you from getting down to that buck in 6 months?
Representative Nathan, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Senator Linthicum, the direct answer to that question is yes. We will proceed with the focus being on getting the sites, the 640 sites, done. I will not put handholds in the expectation that someday I will need them or use them for a facility that I may never be allowed to provide service.
Yes.
follow up. What's the time frame for addressing those 640 sites?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, Senator Lithicum, members of the committee, we're in the we own the fiber now. We've put the $2.5 million down now with Oregon State University. It is my intention to get that back in this biennium.
So 18 months.
Yes, sir.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So, Dr. Pettit, I'm not a telecommunications guy, but if I was a telecommunications guy and I was worried about being undercut by on the service here, there's 3 points in the 13A amendments that would make me nervous. So first of all, it says if you're going to duplicate services, you may only provide those services if you're allowed to in the rules. But you're the guy that's going to make the rules. It's going to be the Department of Administrative Services, and I think that you would be the guy who's going to make the rules. So first of all, that would make me nervous there, and that's not to impugn your character or your whatever integrity or anything like that. The next one is it talks about having a oversight body of, I forget if they call it a commission or a whatever it is, but you're the guy who appoints every member of that oversight body there. So that would be point two that would make me nervous. And then so they call it an advisory committee. And then
what we need to do, let's see here. We can further amend the bill in one of the joint committee members' amendments.
I guess, and then the third one is that I kind of duplicated myself there, is that you're the one that's adopting the rules on that. So this is kind of to overlap with a question of Senator Linthicum, is couldn't you have just put in something in the rules there that would have, or in the amendment that would have said what you're going to do in the rules, or at least enough that would have made the telecoms happy? Wouldn't that have been possible? I agree with you that this is a missed opportunity, or we're staring at a missed opportunity here.
Representative Nathanson, Representative Riley, members of the committee, Representative Nierman, the direct answer is, so if I'm understanding the question, I want to restate the question. If what you're asking is, could we have bounded this in a way that I'm not certain of is what you're asking me. We're talking about whether the way that I understand the proposal is, are those potential municipalities, tribes, and libraries potentially groups that we can serve,
right,
or cannot serve? I think it does speak to that. That's the only thing it speaks to, is whether they're members I can serve or not. I hear your concern about the oversight body in my assignment. I see this as really being a one-time rulemaking effort thing. We're going to go, and as we're going to build out the length on Interstate 84, are we going to stop at the municipal library in Baker City or not? And it's going to be dependent upon, as you say, are there other service providers? And that's all going to be constructed beforehand. I don't know that this is a. I see this as an engineering project that mm-hmm. we're going to go and perform and do, and then when we're done, we're done. So I'm sorry if I've mishandled the question. I'm trying to understand what it is you're asking me.
I'll think if I can follow. I'll take responsibility for not artfully framing the question. But if I was a telecom service provider and I was nervous about you duplicating my services, and even the amendment uses the word duplicate services there, so obviously somebody who crafted this amendment is aware of that problem. Why wouldn't you just fix the problem in the amendment? Why fix it in rulemaking?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Representative Nierman, thank you for the question. Because one of the things that needs to be further articulated through for us, if someone has a 1 megabit satellite connection to the internet, we would not call that a broadband connection. So what we wanted to do in rulemaking is more refine or greater clarity what it is we mean by this broadband service. There are a lot of different definitions out there. There are definitions here that are some of these that we've used before. Our desire really is to make sure that we've got a definition of what it is that's being provided, so that there's a 1 megabit, you know, link to Hayes or Hughes satellite network systems out there doesn't really fit the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Linthicum.
Could we call the telecommunications branch back up and have him respond to some of these issues? I'm not sure if that'd be appropriate or not, but.
At this point, I'm not sure it would be helpful because we do have the written testimony also from both Mr. Wolf and Mr. Hendricks explaining their points. It seems to me a lot of this really hinges on an amendment that was written in, it's not as bad as a double negative, but it's a little bit like convoluted legislative council legalese. You can do something notwithstanding. If it doesn't say this, you go up back up to that paragraph, and then this isn't going to happen unless that. It's a little bit difficult to untangle, but the issue is how do you express the intent and the assurance not to duplicate broadband services that either are provided by the private sector or they're willing to provide in a timely manner, like, yeah, this year we're going to put it in and we can do it for that kind of price. But how do you say it in a way that it then allows for the situations? We just heard the 1 gigabit. Did I get that right? 1 gig versus something else.
Yes.
Much better that they would really need. How do you account for that when you're writing a more general statute? I guess that's the issue. Mr. McSpadden.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, when I worked with the legislative council on this amendment, those were precisely the reasons why that level of detail are not in the statute, because there are any number of scenarios that are different depending on where you are across Oregon's 98,000 square miles. And so the concept here was that the state CIO is already authorized in statute to provide services to state agencies, and the shall language that Senator Linthicum referenced only applies to state agencies. The may applies to other public bodies as defined in conditions that would be outlined within the rulemaking. So the state CIO is not, under the amendment, allowed to provide those services until the rules are adopted. The Rules Advisory Committee is something that is recommended under Oregon administrative rulemaking, but is not required. In this statute, we felt it was appropriate, because of the concerns that had been raised, to require that Rules Advisory Committee. Further to
I specifically asked for a large Rules Advisory Committee that worked over a longer period of time than is typical. Often these processes are done within, 28 days? And I said that's not nearly enough time to discuss the serious issues and for the stakeholders to be heard and to work out all the details. So I did specifically say, as you're finishing up this amendment, that the ideas had come from the prior committee. I'm the one who actually put some more sideboards on there and said it's got to be better than that.
The only other thing that I'd mention for the committee is that the makeup of the Rules Advisory Committee, the 11 identified parties, and essentially a broader category of organizations that might be brought into the rulemaking committee in order for them to complete their work was constructed in the manner that it was, so that both customer and provider were part of the rulemaking process.
Thank you, Senator DeBoer.
Madam Chair, and the rules do come back to us.
Yes, they do.
I have one other question.
Yes.
From Representative Brock Smith, if I could ask it real quick.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, please stay. You might not be done, sir.
Shucks.
Senator David Brock Smith, State Representative of the House, District 1.
Were you for the Dash 13s or against them? I was confused.
I apologize, Senator. I am supportive of the Dash 13s and encourage all of you to take a chance to have these rules come back to you so that we can, and I appreciate Co-Chair Nathanson in her, you know, and really her desire to make sure that this intent is here. I've known no other legislation in my time in this building that has taken such diligence for industry through rulemaking to have the rulemaking longer and to make sure that we have industry represented. And if I can close, one of the reasons I'm for, Senator, is when you're looking at that last mile connection, and we know that last mile connection is going to be subcontracted out to industry, they're going to be the ones that then when you have that hole open, one of the things that this bill does is it allows the matching grant funds, and we can get those E-rate funds to open that hole, that the last mile will then be provided by industry. They have the potential to drop their fiber in that hole as well when they're dropping the fiber to that school, and therefore stub out on the way so that they can be prepared to then invest in providing the broadband service to the homes and so forth that are between the last mile connection and the school. And so when I spoke earlier about the 5G and being able to roll that out, that's what my intent was, is this will assist in leveraging federal dollars for private industry to be able to expand service to rural Oregon, not just the schools, not just the counties, but also to the citizens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Lund.
Just to clarify the issue on the rules, there's this conversation going on, and it appears in Section 6, Sub 5. But before adopting the rules in this section, the state chief information officer shall present the proposed rules. In other words, he'll show them. We don't adopt them. He adopts them. He writes them. He adopts them. We get a looky-see, but we do not ratify or approve those rules in any way. And so I appreciate the sincerity with the rules, the 11 different parties, and even more than that. You know, it's kind of an open-ended clauses. All participating in that task, that's a thumbs up and a great opportunity to get everybody at the table. But we're acting like we've got a handle on it, and we've left the legislature out of the mix. If you know that, you can read council or staff, if you could read specifically that Sub 5 paragraph and tell me where I'm misunderstanding that.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, Senator Linthicum, you are correct. Rules are adopted by executive branch agencies. The legislature does not adopt rules, but certainly has oversight over agency operations and whether they are adhering to legislative direction and or intent. As I had conversations with the stakeholders and the Office of the State CIO about how quickly rules would be developed, they would be developed sometime in the legislative interim. They would be brought back to this committee either in, likely not in May, but potentially May, certainly September or December of 2018, prior to the 2019 legislative session, which is clearly the legislature's opportunity. If it believes that the legislative intent or direction is not being followed, to provide additional direction to the state CIO in whatever manner it might see fit.
Thank you. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I just want to make a few comments if I could. First of all, I apologize for being grouchy. My staff, I think, had incorrectly thought that this was going to be 10 minutes, so I was excused all day. from House business, as you know. It's fine. I was on a committee that's already heard all this, so you all haven't. And I respect that. I just thought we were coming in to vote and leave. So this is a good conversation. Glad you're all having it. I've already had it once. Here's what I would say. I thought your suggested compromise from where it left the committee was a good one. I don't even know it's drafted up exactly as we talked about, which is kind of a right of first refusal. But I want to back up to the policy level for a second, regardless of the words on the paper. There's money on the table we can access. There are rural communities whose futures depend on access to broadband. I can guarantee that because my own brother couldn't move back to Coos Bay until they got broadband with his job. As soon as they got broadband, he immediately moved back there. He works for a global IT consulting firm, flies all over the world, but they had to get broadband. That's dollars. His kids are back in the schools that we went to in Coos Bay, which is hurting badly still from the time I grew up there. And it's only because there's broadband. A project I own part of in Iowa, we're able to invest $500,000 this year into the public school system only because we have fiber on our campus. Now, luckily, somebody privately laid it down before we bought it because I could never have afforded to lay all that fiber. But we have tons of fiber on our campus, but it allowed us to be able to network into a private school and globally to other schools so these kids in this little rural town in Iowa can interact with kids all over the world now on our campus. And the public school, we're paying them tuition so their kids can benefit with our kids who are all international students. So this is not words on paper. The market often doesn't serve rural areas. That's why there's a U.S. Postal Service that delivers rural routes, even though it loses money. My dad was a letter carrier. I know that. There are many places the market won't serve. So government should do it then and offer first right of refusal. If the market can serve it, wonderful. I'm a business guy. I'm a capitalist. All for it. But in the end, I care about these rural people having a shot at their future, and this broadband access is critical. So let's get it going, tap the federal money, bring it back for review if we have to before we go into effect. But I don't want to lose opportunities for rural communities to have access to broadband because we can't figure it out during a short session. Yes, we can.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Senator Riley, did you have an additional comment?
No, I think Representative Klum did a good job.
Okay. Thank you all. I don't see any additional questions right now. We're going to be at ease for another 1 or 2 minutes. You both are ready. Thank you. Senator Riley.
I move adoption of the 813 amendment to House Bill 4023.
Is there discussion on the motion? This is just the amendment. Objections? 1, 2. Motion passes. That's about the amendment.
I move the House Bill 4023 be reported out to do pass as amended and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Discussion on the main bill with the amendment. Any further discussion? Objections? 1, 1. Motion passes. Thank you. Mr. McSpadden, do we need to do anything else before I close that work session?
Co-Chair Nathanson, that item is concluded.
Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 4023. Thank you, Representative Klum.
Thank you very much.
I am opening an informational meeting on a couple of items, and Mr. McSpadden, I'll leave it to you to figure out how much of the informational meeting we will proceed with.
So, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we do have two remaining items that were originally scheduled on the agenda. I will leave it to the co-chair's prerogative. I think to give the topic justice, we should pick one of the two topics.
Sure.
thank the other folks who have stayed as long as they have, and we will bring them back to a future meeting, either in this session or more likely in the interim. But we can bring up the Human Resource Information System project or the Oregon Buys e-procurement project.
Do you have a preference, Mr. Co-Chair?
I do. I'd prefer the e-procurement program.
All righty.
So we'd like presenters from the Oregon Department of Administrative Services and Oregon Department of Education to come up and present in about 15 minutes on the Oregon Buys e-procurement project. Again, we thank the Human Resource Information System project team very much. Thank you so much. And for those of you at the dais, if you could remember to introduce yourself for the record, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Finance Administration for the Department of Education. And with me is Debbie Dennis. She is the State Procurement Officer. And we both are actually coming here today in dual roles. We're both city members currently of the Oregon Buys Program. And we've been asked to come and give you a little bit of information and overview of that particular project. And then also how that is morphing, I should say, into Senate Bill 1565, which Debbie will actually speak to. So I'm going to provide a little overview and history of Oregon Buys, and then Debbie's going to talk more specifically as it relates to Senate Bill 1565. So I guess just a place to start, some of my colleagues have given me a little bit of a hard time. I brought a little bit of a prop for you here, and what this represents, the Department of Education, this is one of my procurement officers. I have six of them. This is one of their files for 1 month. And what is obtained in here is probably about 75 to 80 what we call Form A's or Form B's, essentially requests to do a contract, requests to do a purchase order. And this ends up usually touching probably about 4 to 5 different hands as it moves through our department. So as we represent here in terms of our issue, currently the state is responsible for about procurement is about 10% of the Oregon's budget, which is about $8 billion that we process through our systems. Now, that's done by agencies in many, many different ways. We use different systems, many cases use spreadsheets, we use what's called shadow systems, but there is no essential one system that enables us to be able to acquire, to go through the approval processes for all of our stuff. So, all of this runs through my office on a daily basis from hand to hand, and there is no centralized system that is able to process that effectively. As a result, we have a variety of duplications in our systems. We have a lot of reporting capabilities that are missed in terms of management reporting, and we're not able to effectively leverage our buying power. So over the past 10 years, you'll find various reports that have been issued. You'll find various audits of state agencies. And one of the central themes that you will see in many cases is there's a lack of one system that enables processing of purchasing and procurement throughout an agency. And that is something that we as agencies have struggled with a great deal. So essentially the concept of Oregon Buys is that we have a procurement software delivered as a shared service, and that it's a way for us to obtain a product that can be used by all of the agencies and work under one set of requirements. Again, we all have our different ways as state agencies that we go about our procurement processes, but looking at from a conceptual standpoint, how can we do that in one way under one system? So in terms of just a little bit of overview of what is e-procurement, this gives you a little bit of idea of the different components, but I already mentioned in terms of end-to-end procurement, a basic way to start from the beginning of someone wants to buy something to the point that you actually pay for that. And again, from a contractual standpoint, from a purchase standpoint, having a way to go through that process all electronically. Again, in most agencies, you'll find every bit of it manual at this point. And there is no way currently in place to be able to do that. Also, e-procurement provides in terms of opportunities for what we call catalog type purchasing. So again, we have price agreements through the state, we have different mechanisms to being able to purchase goods and services, but usually we have to go from either system to system to different areas. This would provide, again, that one-stop shop, be able to be actually procure those services online. Also, ways to have vendor as access to be able to use the tools, to be able to find the different opportunities that are out there to be able to integrate into that particular system. Also, similar to ORPIN, having the ability to bid everything online, to be able to do it all in one system as opposed to, again, going from one system or one process to another. And then finally, being able to, and this is something that's really important to me, is in terms of reporting and management reporting, being able to look at the types of purchases that are being made, being able to make comparisons and be more effective in terms of the buying power. That's something, again, not having it all in one place that we are able to effectively do as state agencies. So what's the solution? And I'll kind of move around here a little bit, but one of the things that we as agencies come together was, is there a system that can do that particular type of service for us to be able to put it all one place? And what we have been able to identify is a company by the name of Periscope that provides an e-procurement system, which we now know as Oregon Buys. It automates the entire procurement process end-to-end. It integrates with all of our existing systems, our STARS, our, which is our accounting system, our different types of systems like ORPIN, and it all does it, most importantly, in a real-time way, in an accurate way. So I want to provide just a little bit of history in terms of Oregon Buys. So this all started really back in 2014. And there were really two agencies that it started with the Department of Forestry and the Secretary of State. Department of Forestry had this idea and was looking at ways in which they could approach some form of end-to-end procurement system. Secretary of State also had begun trying to analyze what are the ways to do this. Now, at the time, as we often do, we were all doing this as independent agencies. And so the Department of Education began to partner with forestry to decide, is there a way that we can come together as agencies, perhaps bring others to be able to put this forward? Now, typically, we think of things in terms of an enterprise approach, and our friends at the Department of Administrative Services are very good at what they do, but they also have a lot of other, or at the time, most more importantly, they had a lot of different enterprise projects that were going on, one of them being the HRIS system, which I unfortunately you were unable to hear today. But we all recognize, including the Department of Administrative Services, this was important. This was a system that we all wanted to get to in terms of enterprise. But at the time, there just wasn't enough capacity to be able to do that. So the three agencies came together, started talking about this and how we could develop a model that we all could embrace as the state agencies and move forward, and hopefully with the idea of moving it at some point to an enterprise. We were able to talk to a variety of our other agency partners, and we had six others that joined us in 2005, and we began the concept of this idea, which moved us through obtaining a Stage Gate 1 approval in terms of the concept. During that time and moving into 2016, we were able to actually do a request for information to be able to get more specifics of, again, who would be able to do this. And I know that I kind of jumped ahead in the last slide, but Periscope was the identified partner that was able to do that for us. So we were able to get that information and understand that there was a solution out there that could provide, but could they actually deliver, which moved us more into a RFP process. So we began that in 2016, and with all nine agencies, we came together to develop a common requirement for the new system. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but when you bring nine different agencies together who all have their own different ways of doing business, and you're able to lock in on the common business requirement that we have, that was pretty amazing. And as I recall, we were only two or three items we weren't able to actually come to agreement on. This was a huge collaborative process that we were able to bring together and actually be able to move us to a place where we had a proposal, and that moved us into the Stage Gate 2 approval. And so in 2017, in this last year, is when we had now a contractor, we're able to execute a contract with Periscope that would provide this model. We, as the nine agencies, came together, we pooled our resources, we developed our governance structure. We basically were able to create, and I know this becomes a little unique where usually one agency is approaching it. It was a collection, a consortium of nine agencies that were all able to come forward with a proposal and be able to fund that effectively. One thing I guess I just want to note, Madam Chair, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've worked through a variety of different systems as agencies. This has to be one of the most collaborative approaches that I've ever been a part of in terms of watching nine agencies really come together under one committed purpose of making a solution. And I also want to recognize your staff, Sean McSpaden. He was a part of that process too and has been extremely helpful for us. So again, it was really very rewarding to be able to see this process to come together. And I'm happy to say at the first of this year, we were actually able to kick that project off. And we're now in the development stage of what we call the Oregon instance, which is what is basically the backbone of this system that all the agencies will be able to eventually share. Just a little bit of information in terms of our structure, how we've been put together. As I already mentioned, as executive sponsor committee, we represent the nine agencies. I would also like to mention, because others have been able to see how well this has come together, ODOT joined us. They became the 10th agency to come on board, which is really significant because they do a whole bunch of the procurement. So they came on board with us this last year. They are now the 10th agency as a part of our executive sponsorship committee. We're now really more in oversight mode, where we're putting our oversight and standards committee that are actually working with the project team right now in terms of the development of the as-is processes, all of the different requirements, and ensuring that we're able to effectively put this system together. And then we have a program administrator and a project team that has all come together in terms of our governance. So real quickly, here's the 10 agencies that have done this. The 10th, as I mentioned, the Department of Transportation came on board with us this year. But this was you can see the original nine that came together. This is a part, and being a financial guy, I always like to be able to really emphasize. This is the budget to build what we call, again, Oregon Instance. It's going to be the core. It's going to be basically the system that we all eventually move into and do our own development and actually integration into that system. But the $1.5 million you see here, this is the total cost. And again, all nine of these agencies were the ones that pooled their dollars together to be able to fund this. When this originally started, all of us had policy pack. We were doing this very individually. I remember specifically we had a $2 million ask. So take $2 million times nine, you would have had $18 million of request if you had individual projects. We were able to come together and say we can build the core at 1.5, and then we will have our own implementation when we are ready to go on, which will be significantly less. So from just an overall cost savings, this is huge as it relates to how we approach this as a consortium. Just to give you, and again, I know we're on short of time, but just real quickly in terms of the Oregon Bias Project key dates, again, we were able to kick off the Oregon instance January of 18. We're in mode right now to be able to develop all of the business, make sure all the business requirements are put together. We're currently working to finish our process inventory in March of 18. June of 18, we'll have a functional design deliverable, so the Oregon instance will be, at least at that point, we'll have the skeleton put together, and then we will start user acceptances in terms of August of 2018, and then in October, we are hoping for deployment. Now, what this does is it becomes, again, as I said before, it's the core system. So basically, the backbone is built. Now, the agencies, as they are ready, and this is a real critical piece, and all those agencies will have to work through the process of ensuring that they are ready to proceed and work through the stage gate process. But all those agencies then will be able to plug into those core requirements. Secretary of State, Department of Forestry, they will be the first ones. So us other eight are watching very closely as they begin to proceed. And then slowly, as each of the different agencies are ready to deploy and move in, they'll have that system, they'll be ready to plug into it, and they'll be able to manufacture it to their specific needs, which begins to now segue into Debbie's portion of this as it relates to Senate Bill 1565 and how this is looked at as a potential enterprise moving forward.
We have a question. I will also note that we are scheduled to adjourn at 4:30. Senator Riley.
So very quickly, could you bring the first screen back up quickly? So the number in the top one, the $8 billion in biennial spending, if I'm remembering this correctly, that 1% of that is going to come from the vendors and the not the vendors, but the people who are selling you a product. Right. They're going to be paying 1% to the vendor of this system. If I do it right, and I may not. That's 800,000?
80 million, right?
80 million?
It would be 1% of 8 billion?
Yeah, 80 million.
Yeah.
So are we somewhere saving $80 million on a biennial basis?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, I'm going to punt this to my colleague because this is where the public-private partnership funding model that you're referring to is part of the Senate Bill 1565 and the funding for the enterprise. But let me just make sure I clarify in terms of the Oregon Buys project, which is continuing to move forward, that particular model is funded. And it's funded by the agencies and the commitment. So if Senate Bill 1565 does not go forward, the Oregon Pies will continue to move forward, and the 10 agencies have a funded model already in place. But I'm going to defer to Debbie in terms of talking about the enterprise.
And I'm going to interject here because I want to be respectful of our members' time, and you probably count on us adjourning at 4:30. Is that correct?
I'm okay.
Okay, so 5 or 10 minutes is.
I'm okay.
Okay. We will stop by 20 till. So you have just a few minutes to answer the question and blast through the next two slides because there is going to be a hearing on Senate Bill 1565 with a much more thorough presentation and questions.
Okay. So Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Dennis, and I am with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm the state's chief procurement officer. So I'm going to jump very quickly to your question, Senator Riley. If you could slide ahead to the slide, that one right there. So this is a piece of our presentation that we are continuing to struggle with explaining. So bear with me, and I hope I can be clear. The state spends $8 billion biennially. The 1% fee is only on the purchases off of our statewide price agreements. Mm-hmm. And we currently spend just under $1 billion a biennium on statewide price agreements. So the 1% fee that would be collected and then shared between Periscope and the state is only on the $1 billion.
Follow up. So that's current. When you get that price catalog out, mm-hmm. and everybody can see it and it's easier to use, mm-hmm. that's going to go up.
Absolutely. So the expectation is that the mix of the $8 million will change over time. We're projecting a 10% increase in our statewide price agreement spending pattern, which would draw down from the $7 million part and grow the $1 billion part over time. And we think that it'll probably level off and only grow inflationary after about 3 or 4 years.
Okay. So instead of 80 million, mm-hmm. We're now talking about maybe 20 million.
10 from that picture, well, and then add on to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe 20 million. Tops.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So are we saving that 20 million somewhere?
So thank you for the question, Co-Chair Riley. So the vendor, Periscope, will need to be compensated for standing up this multi-million dollar system. And so a large portion of that revenue will go to Periscope. So that we're not going to invest $10 or $12 million up front. We're going to not pay anything up front, and then they will recoup their investment over time. Mm-hmm. The revenue share model shifts over time so that the state is receiving more of that revenue, and Periscope would be receiving less. And so What we would anticipate doing is to adjust our rates at DAS, in DAS procurement, so that we are relying more heavily on this revenue source and less heavily on either other administrative fees that we're charging or assessments to agencies.
So I still didn't hear anything about savings.
I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood your question. I understood the question to be, are we taking this revenue and saving it to invest in other things?
No.
Now I understand your question was, are we able to reduce our prices and save the state money on this $8 billion they're spending?
Correct.
Okay. So one of the largest benefits of having an e-procurement system is having access to the spend patterns and the data. And once we know what agencies are buying, how much they're buying, and how frequently they're buying it, we will be able to negotiate much better deals with our suppliers.
Okay. That's fine.
Can I gonna go real quick?
Yes.
So do you get any advantage from getting rid of ORPIN? Do you not have to pay anything because you're not using ORPIN anymore?
Sure. Co-Chair Nathanson and Representative Nierman, there will be a small savings in decommissioning ORPIN. We currently pay about $150,000 a year in maintenance fees to our ORPIN vendor, and then there are server fees because that is not a software as a service. So we have some hosting fees internally that we pay to host all of that data. Those fees wouldn't go away right away because we would need to archive the data and have it be accessible.
Yes,
sir. Madam Chair, I would like to see that transaction fee or the revenue shared between vendor and the percentages and how long. And am I to assume that there is no upfront cost for this, that they're going to get paid through their revenue sharing?
Chair Nathanson and Senator DeBoer, that is correct. There would be no upfront payment. The $1.5 million that my colleague Rick spoke about, we would put that on pause. That those fees that have not been expended would be folded into this model, and there would be no upfront fee paid to Periscope. They would only be compensated through the success of the system.
So then just a follow-up question. You know how much you're going to spend, you know how much their fees are, so I'd like that kind of put together in a total number to see what Periscope is expecting to receive mm-hmm. over that period of time mm-hmm. and what happens when you reach the number that makes the $1.5 million.
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator DeBoer, we have the preliminary data. We have not fully negotiated our deal, but we do have the preliminary data and the proposal from Periscope, and I'd be happy to bring that back and share it with the members of the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Communicate with Mr. McSpaden about that and Great. Share with us what is appropriate, given
yes.
that some of this must be proprietary and subject to negotiation, but
yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. So just one follow-up, yes. Madam Chair. I was presented this some time ago. I have serious concerns about it, that the cost and the savings, and especially a transaction fee of 1% for everybody selling you something. So I just want to express my concerns.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Mr. McSpaden, can you tell us real quickly about any written reports that have been submitted that we have available to review? We're done with this topic now.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. One quick point as our previous presenters leave the dais, wanted to make clear this is a software as a service solution. Although the word development was used, I think, and if you could just shake your head yes or no if I'm correct, that the development really is focused on any interface with other systems. Preparing the system for use by the agencies is more of a configuration type of activity. So there isn't custom code to the primary system.
Thank you.
Great. So the last two items we have are written reports. They are posted on OLIS. One comes from the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of the State CIO on the IT Vendor Management Program called Basecamp. Please, as you can, read through that status update. The last item has to do with House Bill 2906. As you know, that was a JLCIMT-sponsored bill that was passed in the 2017 legislative session. Their written report updates this committee on their progress to date. I'm very glad to say the Oregon Geographic Information Council has been formed, much in the form that that was called for. Generally, an even split between state agencies and non-state agencies, and they're off and running.
Okay, great, good to hear. Any questions about Mr. McSpadden's comments? We have no other business before us. The informational hearing meeting is closed, and we are adjourned. Great.